The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Welcome back to the official Project Blue Book podcast. I'm your host, Tara Bennett, a senior producer for Sci-Fi Wire. So, War Games is a dark episode in topic and execution. Hynek and Quinn are in some serious mortal danger with some soldiers who are being used as guinea pigs in this episode, and their partnership is unraveling and it comes to a boiling point. And then the generals are also in the thick of it all, so let's go through it all. We've got with us again our creator and co-executive producer, David O'Leary.
Hey, everybody.
And showrunner and executive producer, Sean Jablonski.
Hello.
And two of our favorite cast returnees, we've got Michael Mullarkey, Captain Quinn.
Hey there.
And as always, we love bringing in Michael Harney as General Valentine. Welcome back, sir.
Thank you.
And we have an extra guest for this episode of the podcast. Early in the week, I sat down to chat with executive producer Jackie Levine for Campare, the TV division of Robert Zemeckis' company Image Movers. And we are going to talk about War Games and what she does as an executive producer on Project Blue Book. And we're going to get to that special pre-recorded segment a little later on. All right, so we've got a lot going on. And the next case that we've got with Quinn and Hynek, we start with that really cool military footage of the lights in the woods and the firefights. It's very found footagey. Tell me about what you wanted to do with that, because it's a compelling way of setting up this case.
This case was actually based on true events that actually happened overseas during the Korean War, where these soldiers on the ground basically saw these orange orbs of light that descended on them, what they claim fired some sort of mist at them, some sort of like ray at them, something. Soldiers got sick and all that kind of stuff, burn marks and all that. And what was interesting about that case is this was something that the Center of UFO Studies, which was Hynek's organization post Project Blue Book that he founded, investigated. So when we came across this case, we thought it was fascinating, but we wanted to make sure that we could get Hynek and Quinn out into the field. So what we did is, instead of it being amidst the Korean War, we moved it to a Korean War training facility so that we could bring our guides there to the location. And there was all kinds of theories about what had happened there. Like, they didn't know, was this some sort of weapon that was being utilized or what? So we just sort of took that incredible case, which, by the way, is still unsolved. And there's a great summary of it on like history.com and other places.
It's also, and the generals speak to this, I think your line is essentially, our troops were attacked by an unknown object. Under any other things, this would be considered an act of war.
That's exactly, right. Yeah.
Which is 100% true.
Yes.
We had American troops attacked by an unknown force from something that inflicted casualties of some degree. It's a huge case, still unsolved. The idea that our military came under attack, that was what made this case so interesting.
It starts to get really sinister, and this is our people being hurt by our people. Tell me about setting up the generals to be bigger players in this episode, and then also the effects that it has on Quinn and Hynek.
Coming off of Seven especially, I think where we wanted to get to with all of our characters was put everybody in this stress test. You're looking at the partnership between Hynek and Quinn is at a breaking point, but they're having to sort of figure out how to work together under this circumstance. You look at those soldiers when they go at each other, and I think Quinn even says, this is not right. You look at Mother Nature. Birds used to cooperating together, attacking each other. The generals, when Fairchild goes behind their back and tests them out, our drive was to go, how can we take that same kind of paranoia that's going on in the real world and put it onto our guys and stress them and see what happens?
Michael, talk to me a little bit about how you and Neil were playing the generals in this sequence, because last podcast we had Neil talk about, we're never 100% sure where the generals are coming from in any given episode.
Well, we never really want anybody to know where we're coming from.
That's good. Enigmatic.
Yeah, and that's a way of being in terms of holding authority over people, right? I mean, it's a manipulation, actually, but it's a way of controlling subordinates. That being said, there's also a tremendous amount of an embracing of multiple pieces of information.
Yes.
And dealing with multiple assets and trying to orchestrate multiple avenues with action. And then when somebody shows up and does something behind our backs and doesn't bring us into the loop, especially when it has to do with hurting our own guys,
yeah.
That for me personally, characterologically, was a huge betrayal. I don't know, embracing the gray area, but yet maintaining very clear authority.
It's also, in an interesting way, a little comeuppance in terms of what Harding did to Quinn in the last episode. Nobody's really in a position of where it can't come back and bite them in the ass, proverbially.
Right.
So
that's the thing. You don't really know. You're really flying by the seat of your pants in many respects. And the only way to really handle it is by having a firm lock on yourself.
Right.
Just following orders and also creating orders together, Neil and I.
Let's talk about Quinn and Hynek out in the field. It's disturbing, obviously, for Quinn to see these guys going after each other.
Breaking protocol.
Yeah, exactly. But he's also going back into a case with Hynek, who he's not exactly on chipper ground with him either. So this is like a breaking point for him.
This was an interesting one, because one of my favorite little anecdotes from this was when we saw the murmuration of the birds out
yeah.
in the field. On the day, we had a couple dudes in some cranes throwing satchels of rubber starlings at us. Aiden and I, while we were like dodging and ducking out of the way. I mean, it initially started where we were having to imagine it.
Of course.
He's like, all right, there's 5 birds falling. Now there's 10 and 20. And we're like, okay, is this working? And then eventually they started throwing real birds. Not real birds, the rubber ones.
The rubber ones, yeah.
They didn't kill like
all birds were
no
protected.
Animals were killed.
Exactly.
No, no. They might have been startled by what we were doing out there. But.
They're watching from their street like, what is happening?
Yeah.
Everything's coming to a boiling point. I love the fact that Quinn doesn't end up ratting Hynek out, even though he has a prime and ample opportunity to do that. And yeah, it was an intense shoot. I mean, I remember the fight scene out in the rain in Vancouver. I mean, we were just talking about how I had to wear like 3 or 4 layers of thermals. And if Quinn ever looked stiff, it's mostly because of that.
The poor man's trying not to freeze to death in the water.
That's why you really lost the fight, because it was so chilly.
It's too cold. I can't fight under these conditions. But no, it's some great stuff. Everything's really boiling over in preparation for our wonderful final 2 episodes.
He used the perfect word for a segue, boiling over with Corporal Wells and his
oh yeah,
his ability to boil a cup of water right. all on his own. So tell me about that character and what you wanted to kind of manifest through him, because it's quite interesting.
In the whole first half of the season, we are talking about this deep program that's going on with people who've been touched by the experience of contact with UFOs and how the government's trying to use them to talk back and all that kind of stuff. So we wanted the Wells character became the embodiment of somebody who has completed the program. Unlike Fuller, who escapes, Harding and Valentine aren't sure the nature of what they're dealing with. They
right.
think genuinely it is some sort of attack from an unknown force.
It was inspired by all the MK Ultra stuff and the experiments that the CIA did through psychedelics, through other means, you know, trying to do remote viewings,
yeah.
all of this stuff. And a lot of times they did it, and this was the inspiration for it. They would do it without letting people know. And if you can imagine, I think the joke was, you know, you might have LSD in your coffee and not know it in
right.
the morning at the CIA.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the sequence in the van when they are going out and you're with all of those soldiers that are starting to lose it. It's such a great, tense moment. Poor Quinn is sitting there going, oh, this
is kind of like the waiting room in an audition.
It's going down.
Minus
it's
the guns.
It's going down bad. So tell me about playing that out.
Well, it was great. I mean, we've really, I don't say lucked out, because it's not all luck, but we've really got so many great guests, artists who come in, and they really brought it and were invested. And the thing that I love about playing Quinn is that he's always assessing. He walks into a room, he's looking at the exit, he checks out body language of everybody. Not all of this is probably picked up, but, you know, I spend a lot of time with him watching and analyzing. And he's, especially in this kind of situation, it's very intense. He's with the actual people who had the exposure.
Yeah.
So, but he's not ready for what's about to happen. And luckily, Hynek saves the day this time. He turns up with this.
That egghead this runs right in and helps.
Wonderful story of like, he pretends that they were all under a test, right. Blah, blah, blah. I'll never forget that moment of kind of looking at him going, all right. Yeah, man.
I love that.
That was some high intensity stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember going through that and afterwards just being exhausted. A lot of running in the woods as well.
I think that scene holds the record for the most revisits from an editorial standpoint.
Really?
I must have recut that for a month.
Well, you were cross-cutting that one as well,
cross-cutting,
right?
But also trying to sort of eke out every little bit of tension. There's so many angles in that truck. There are so many little moments. It's actually flipped when you look at the script. I think the back half plays first and then the front half and then how you lay music in and mm-hmm. then cross-cutting. It was a beast.
And I don't know if we've yet given a shout-out to Daniel Wall, who's the wonderful guy
who did
the music for the show, because really it creates such a almost Hitchcockian element to the series, and he's done a great job and he deserves a shout out.
For real. And this episode, as you pieced it together and you see these elements, it was at a certain point, it's like, we just need to lean into this almost like a genre piece and say,
yes,
this needs to feel like a thriller horror movie. And I remember even that scene looking at, you know, you always put temp music in a scene until you score it. And I would go, look at Seven, look at Silence of the Lambs. How do we feel like there's this menace, thrilling thing going on without it feeling like a slasher film? So when talking to Daniel, it was like, go for it. This should feel like not an outlier, but each episode has its own identity.
Totally.
This one was, when you look at Wells, when you look at the creepiness of those birds, you look at the soldiers, you look at the nighttime fights, it's just lean into that.
I just remembered a fun little anecdote. So Aiden and I are in the tent dissecting the bird.
Yeah.
We had an argument over whether it was a real bird or not for at least half an hour in between scenes. And he was like, no, smell it. Seriously. No, come down here. Get your nose down in it. And I was like, I don't know if I want. Okay. I was like, oh, actually, it does smell kind of putrid.
At some point, I got to look at the practical effects or special effects guys who actually built
it. It was incredible.
It was awesome. Yeah. It's like the little organs.
We were fooled.
It's like a dissection class.
That's good stuff, man. The magic. So, before we dig into further aspects of this episode with the guys in the studio, let's pause for a moment and go to that chat I had with Project Blue Book executive producer, Jackie Levine. Hello, Jackie. It is so wonderful to have you on the show. Tell me about when you first had the Blue Book idea come across your desk and why you thought it would be a great project for Campari.
Hi, Tara. So great to talk to you and thrilled that you wanted to have me on your podcast. Yeah, let me tell you how it all started. I was sent a spec script, a script that somebody writes speculatively on their own, called Blue Book. I read it and I thought, wow, what a great script. What a great idea. I know this is something that both Bob Zemeckis and Jack Rabke, who I work with, who grew up in this time period and would be very much interested in the subject matter. I love these characters. The fact that it's based on this real man, Alan Hynek, who was in the movie Close Encounters that Bob Zemeckis' friend and mentor Steven Spielberg directed. And he was also the consultant on that movie. There were so many aspects of this project that I felt really dovetailed well with our company, along with the fact that it was just a great idea. So I submitted the script along with David O'Leary, who wrote this and is a terrific guy and a really great writer, to Mark Tuohy at A&E. He read it pretty quickly and had recently started and I think realized right away this fits exactly what we want to do. And I think with the pedigree of our company and Robert Zemeckis and the concept, everybody over at A&E and quickly History Channel got very excited. Then we were on a fun journey of figuring out what the season was. You're so grateful to have this kind of opportunity and the real work begins, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Then it's scripts and figuring out your cases.
Yeah.
I do have to ask, Robert has done so many wonderful period pieces. And like you said, this is a topic that has already been one that's been interesting for him. Were there conversations that you had with him about, okay, I'd really love to see if you guys could try to tackle this in the first season of the show?
He knew of Project Blue Book. He knew of some of these cases. We were all reading up. it was a really collaborative process. He didn't have any one specific case. He was said, you need to incorporate or avoid something. I think it was really trying to figure out what we all felt would make the best season of entertainment.
Did you go down the rabbit hole? You know, obviously, when you're researching, you're going, what can we do? Was there a case that you felt would be well-framed for the first season?
Yeah, I think for me, I really like the Flatwood Monster. That one, for me, always felt exciting and unusual. I also was drawn to the Lubbock Light. And my job, having worked both in film and television for many, many years, was a lot of character.
Yeah.
And really, who are these characters? And how can we make them as dimensional as possible? And how can we make this, I guess, bromance between Hynek and Quinn as exciting and dynamic as possible? And also see his home life and the struggles that he had and how that affected his wife.
We've talked before in the podcast about how the series shoots two episodes with one director. And tell me about one about bringing Thomas Carter in for the block with the Scoutmaster and War Games, where you found him, and then what it was like being able to be there for the block that he was shooting.
Sure. Coming from Robert Zemeckis's company, which is a director-driven company, obviously directors are very important to us in everything that we do. And I think a lot of my career has been working with directors and really cultivating relationships with directors. I love to find them, nurture them, bring them into the fold. I'm a parent of two teenage girls, and so part of really taking care of directors directly relates to parenting as well. So one helps the other, let's put it that way. But specifically, Thomas Carter is someone who Image Movers in particular had wanted to work with on the feature side initially and had talked to him about a couple different projects that predated my involvement with the company. But I separately had met him and talked to him about a couple of things. So he was somebody that we had revered as a director. And so when his name came up as someone that was available for the block of 7 and 8, he just had such passion and enthusiasm for the project. We didn't have scripts at the time, but we had some kind of ideas about what the episodes would be. And he just loved what we were trying to do. And being on set with him was terrific. He was really great with the crew and just terrific with the actors. I thought that he was smart about spending the time that he needed on performance while making sure that he got the visuals, and particular in 108 with the officer going through the hallway and the light blinking out. He had planned that and timed that with the director of photography. It was exciting to see that happen. It was exciting to see it in the episode.
You know, working on this show, it is unique in that it's a period piece. We don't get a ton of those on television, but it's also diving right into the intrigue of these unexplained stories that have captivated us literally over generations. Why is it important to be doing these kinds of stories out there?
Well, I think the past teaches us about the present, and between UFOs and alien sightings for hundreds and hundreds of years. And this was a particular time when people were in a vulnerable place. You had the Cold War going on, you had the space race going on, and I think people's minds were opened in a way that they never had been before. And I think it's exciting to think about what else is out there. How can we look at the world in a way where it's not just our tiny microcosm of our life and our day-to-day activity and our struggles? When you step back and you think about what else is out there in the world, and that we're just like a small part of a much larger system and universe, I think it's really enlightening. And so I think it's important to show this time in history, and Hynek's character particularly, between being a skeptic and becoming a believer. Mm. And what does that mean? And how do you get into that kind of situation where you have the proof and the evidence to really believe in something?
Yeah.
At the time, they felt like these alien sightings were fake news and that we have to stay away from that. And so I think in some ways it was like the birth of fake news. But when you watch the show and you start to read about these cases, you realize there's a lot of scientific facts and evidence that this wasn't so fake.
Yeah.
So I just think it's important to kind of look at what was happening then and what's happening now and see the correlation. that's what we try and do with every episode, is make it feel relevant, make it feel interesting, exciting to people today, that has like this heightened element that's also really based in reality and grounded. It's always been important for all of us to keep it incredibly grounded. All those elements together make for good TV.
It certainly does. It's been super compelling. I want to thank you so much for your time, Jackie, and we will definitely have you back for season two.
Well, thank you, Tara. I really appreciate you having me on the show. Happy to come back anytime.
Thank you, Jackie, for that fascinating chat about your role in the show and your thoughts on this episode. And back to you four gentlemen in the studio. So, I wanted to talk also about the Mimi of this episode, because she makes a pretty definitive decision and she goes to Susie and says, let me get this gun thing going because someone's coming to my house. You help me out by coming in with a gun and maybe I need to start doing that on my own. And that's a big swing for a suburbanite woman. And it also, again, aligns her more with Susie's decision making than her husband's.
Yeah, I mean, it was a sort of a passing of the mantle in a way, where Mimi is stepping up and taking that power. And I mean, obviously a gun represents a lot, but it also shows a willingness to do what she feels she needs to do to protect herself and her family. And so that idea just felt like a really strong idea. That scene in the woods of them doing target practice too, what I really love about that scene is there's so much more at play going on. And again, it's these two women who are exercising a different kind of power that wasn't really, not necessarily accepted, but also displayed at that time.
Absolutely.
For me, it delivered on a lot of levels.
And I love that when she finally does get to experience the power, we see the elation. It's not like, oh, this is too much. It's like, I want to go again. It speaks to who she is and what's bubbling underneath that's going to continue.
Let's go to that moment with the Michaels where we have Quinn confronting the generals.
We talked about father figures before, and, you know, they're kind of two different paternal figures for Quinn. And, you know, you do shout at your parents, don't you? But I don't want to devalue the whole system and everything. It's not as simple as that, like a parent-son type thing. But it definitely feels like that big of a deal for Quinn, I guess, which is why I roped that in. But, I mean, it's just great when we have scenes where we can really get into stuff that's outside of the chain of command like that, you know, what's emotionally going on.
For me, it was about conscience and really allowing myself to have a moment of humanity with Michael, which was brief, but it was, I thought, well shot. And out of that, I feel that respect is evident. And that's, I think, why it's so hard to be in a leadership position where oftentimes you're making calls that have to do with other lives and the effect of your orders on other lives, whether they be positive or negative, or be out of control in this case. You know, this particular case, we didn't know, so.
That moment of humanity then allows you to go up your chain of command and go, this is not what we want to be doing to our men. And what was it like being able to play that moment where you actually do have the ability to show your ire rather than, hey, we need to do this for the greater good, and going, no, this isn't good with either one of us.
For me personally, again, in terms of the character and what I know about these models that I'm working off of, every attempt is made to the point of exhaustion to not bring harm to our own men in any particular case. That being said, what he did to me was viewed and experienced organically as a major betrayal because he broke rank. Again, in the world that we're living in, that's like you broke the biggest commandment.
Yeah.
And then to do it in a way whereby our men suffered in that way. And I have information, intelligence information, that tells me that, you know, these guys are really messed up.
Yeah.
Now. These guys are really in for a bad ride. So, again, humanly, we're able to take some license with our poetic journey in film, and we're able to go into these places and bring meaning that wouldn't, under realistic circumstances, may not have a moment to breathe, because you wouldn't know what the hell was going on.
Every character has like such complicated conflicts of interest, which I don't think is as apparent in a lot of other shows. You know, there's a lot more cut and dry things happening.
Yeah, there's no black and white with this.
You know, there's not a right and wrong. There's a what do I do right now in this situation to appease my situation, which I think is part of the genius of the writing, is threading
Part of the what?
The genius of my acting is...
That's what I thought. That's
yeah, thanks.
And to be able to do that in a military situation, that's not easy. These guys sitting here, David and Sean, helming a process by which we're able to reflect behavior in such a way that viewers will be able to identify on a gut level. How often do you see military people portrayed simply as, that's it. It's
rigid.
By the book.
Exactly.
And
that's
not the case here. So that's a testament to these guys.
I think it's a lot like running a television show. You have to follow orders sometimes, and you have to make it work. Right.
You don't know what tomorrow
you're being
will
under a stress test, and there are many levels to it. Do you know what I mean? There is the Captain Quinn level, there is the generals, there is the Department of Defense, and then there's something even larger than that, and it's always something. And I say it tongue-in-cheek, but it's funny, even just listening to this now, I'm like, you know, this sounds very familiar to me. that, you know, tensions can get high. Yeah. You have a lot of agendas. You have a lot of people that have input in that. It's that parable about the five blind people touching the elephant, right? You know, the one touches the trunk and is like, well, that's a snake. Another touches a leg. Oh, that's a tree trunk, you know? So it's like you have all of these different points of view and people who are focused on certain ideas that what they feel is important. And then you sort of have to find your way through all of that. And I think I can empathize and sympathize and sit in the shoes of every person in that world. Captain Quinn, I think I understand to a great degree, who's just doing the job and trying to make it right. And sometimes you want to charge into somebody's office and go, what the fuck?
Yes.
You know, it's interesting, too, if I may say, that there's a greater intention for us to achieve, which is safety. But what that does is it allows all of these human elements to come up to the surface, but they have to be put aside and they have to be sacrificed for the greater good. That doesn't mean they're not there. And that's what I was getting at before with the writing, is that they're allowed to breathe in the midst of this greater good. It's not just about the greater good. It's the greater good with fallible people that have shortcomings and differences of opinion and conflict.
And that's a great segue into one of our last topics. Hynek makes the decision to tell Quinn about Unseen and about the object. Did you see that as being kind of a watershed moment?
Well, I think now they're almost in too deep. They both have stuff on the other. If it hasn't been sealed before, it's sealed the deal of a proper, you know, partnership. And the thing is, you know, like I said before, Quinn might seem like skeptical about this stuff, but you get hit with this kind of information, and if you're remotely interested, you're going to be like, whoa, hang on, what you what now? What is this guy saying? It's kind of like with my research in this material to begin with. I felt like, okay, yeah, aliens, UFOs. And I started kind of looking into this stuff, hearing different things, and I'm like, whoa, okay, I'm in.
Yes.
You know, and I think this is kind of, Quinn's becoming gradually more and more invested and interested, and especially with the cracks that are beginning to show with the generals and feeling like a pawn, there has to be something that he can cling on to that's going to make him keep going on willingly. And I think that's in a way where he's at with it. It's very strained, but it's an interesting place to be.
It's also interesting when Hynek goes home and showed his wife the artifact. He comes in with this kind of judgy attitude of like, what are you smoking and drinking in the middle of the day now? Right. And it's like, yeah, maybe because she's been driven there by all of your withholding, buddy. You're withholding.
By the way, what's wrong with smoking and drinking in the middle of the day?
Isn't that what we're doing?
Is that not okay? Okay.
Who hasn't had a day like that? Hello.
Can't do it alone. That's the rule, apparently. Right.
We don't know how bad Joel was that day.
You can't? Okay. Sorry. I'm learning things too.
She just says, listen, things are broken here. Just because you gave me some information at one point doesn't mean that this has really changed the game and how we're still interacting with each other, and you got to make a choice. That's a big moment.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It's like, how much did he really divulge? He certainly shares the artifact, but does he divulge with Mimi how he got it, who, from where he got it, right? It's sort of like, Family or Blue Book? What are you going to choose?
And I always felt like that was just the moment that had to happen to be authentic for Mimi, because without it, she's got no teeth.
Right.
Yeah. Do you know what I mean? And she's just a speed bump that's just sort of there to kind of add a little tension and whatnot. But it's like, that is a real character coming forward and following their drive and honest desires, which is like, wait, hold up. I got a kid in the house. I bought a gun.
Yes.
No, I did not sign up for this. This is you. You got to make a choice now because I'm not doing it. There was something inevitable about it. And I'm glad we got there in 8 when we did, because it's true. You know, it's true.
And then lastly, we just end with Unseen picking up the artifact. So obviously it had been influencing a lot of what was happening with Wells and certainly with the major plot points. But now it's out of Alan's hands.
That's right.
And it's in Unseen's hands.
That's right. And listen, Unseen is the one who tasks Hynek to get the object to begin with. Unseen wanted that object. That's all I'll say.
He got what he wanted. What does that mean? We don't know. So that's where we leave this episode today. And thank you so much for being able to dissect all of the elements of this very meaty episode. And as always, I want to thank everybody for being here today. David, Sean, and Michael. Thank you so much.
And thank you all for listening every week. It's great to have you all.
Absolutely.
You guys are the best. Thanks so much for downloading us every week and all of your wonderful comments online. Make a difference, and we all appreciate it. We look at them all the time. So thanks everybody for being here, and we will see you next week. Thank you again to my wonderful guests. This show would not be as cool and as interesting without all of their wonderful insight. And as always, I also have to give it up for my wonderful podcast team, producer Kirby Dixon, producer-editor Paul Terry, mixer and master Dave Draper, and thank you so much for LA Digital Recording for being our home again this week. Thank you very much for all of your downloads, all of your recommendations, letting other people know that the podcast exists. If you like it, always feel free to give us a little review and let others know that it is a worthy listen out there. We want to let you hopefully appreciate the show on a much deeper level every week with this podcast. And so keep watching the skies.